What up, YouTube,
Are we live?
And it's live. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of That's Where You Go and Finish.
The morality
of
every
day
things.
Ah, wow, that was shockingly cute, wasn't it?
Maybe we do that again. Welcome to the morality of everyday things.
Podcast where we discuss everyday ethics. I'm Anthony.
I'm Jake.
We're longtime friends, studied together, run a couple of businesses together. For those who are watching the video, you can see that Jake's wearing his Stasher t-shirt. We also run a social enterprise called treepoints.green, or just treepoints, helping you go carbon neutral and plant trees all over the world. If you have a business that wants to plant trees, you want to go carbon neutral personally, check it out. For our longtime listeners, same request as always, please do leave a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever your podcast player is, or, you know, just spray paint it onto a wall near your house. Anything that really, you know, tell your friends. If you can't leave a review, tell your friends. Oh my God, I know these amazing guys. Enough about that. Today's episode is actually, for those who know me, it's a bugbear of mine. Jake, you're a little more mixed on it, aren't you?
Well, the question is, to jump into it, should we abolish the monarchy? And as long as I've known Anthony, I've known how he feels about this.
Mm. I normally start by saying, hi, I'm Anthony and I hate the royal family.
And like you say, yeah, I've never really had particularly strong opinions, I suppose.
Just in general, or?
Just in general, yeah. I maybe grew up more sort of culturally British than you did, in the sense of like...
Could you please say that in a more conventionally British accent?
I maybe grew up more culturally.
I like that you went high class British.
Oh, what did you want? You
wanted... I was figuring more man of the people, British, you know? Yeah. Grew up more like, you know,
anyways.
Typical British lad, loved the Queen. Love the king.
Queen and country
in it. Got a pub nearby. It's called Queen's Head. Love me some Queen's Head. Way.
Naughty.
That's how I imagine English people sound. I live here. I should know.
Yeah. But yeah, interesting question, right? Because I suppose...
You're making it sound terribly interesting, mate.
Let me go again. Interesting question, because what everyone who's ever given this much thought will have noticed is that monarchies are kind of a dying thing. I mean,
it's so passé.
In Europe, we've gone from having 22 monarchies to just 12 over the last 100 years.
Wow.
But Britain's, I think, is a little bit special in terms of its...
In a typically British fashion, we seem to cling to some sort of old tradition that makes us feel like we're better than everyone else.
And it certainly, you can see that playing out in terms of its international influence, if nothing else. There's a kind of... I suppose practically the Queen is also the monarch of, what, 15, 16 other Commonwealth nations, right?
Hmm, this so is true. This is true.
There's that fact. But the Queen certainly holds a lot of power, and the royal family more broadly.
Yes. I mean, speaking of the royal family more broadly, this is something we've discussed at length in the context of Harry and Meghan recently. I'm sure that we'll touch on some of their recent issues. And you know what? Some of you will know that Prince Philip died. He's prince because... He was not the rightful... If you're married to the Queen but not the rightful king, then you are forever prince. Anyway, Prince Philip very rudely died when we first intended to record this episode.
It's pretty bad inconsiderate. His part.
I know, right? And I found it quite surreal. You know, okay, I kind of get the Queen, but like the outpouring for Prince Philip, I was like, really? The guy who's famous for like saying racist stuff? Like, his media tropes are like pretty... I mean, I'm sure he did some other things. I'm a bit too young to really appreciate like anything other than his geriatric lifespan. Basically, not to speak ill of the dead, but I was surprised by the level of... I mean, like, for those in the UK, it was just all they talked about on the radio for about a day. Oh, not a day, a week.
And it went on for 2 weeks of official mourning period, oh, right? Wow. It was a surprisingly big deal. I remember there was some other relevant news story we were looking at, and it completely got overshadowed on that day. Prince Philip died, and it was like media kind of blanket coverage.
Was it Earth Day, possibly?
It was coming up to that. It would have been around that time. So yeah, there would have been something we would have been looking at. Anyway, by the by.
It's by the by. But yes, so monarchy is an institution we should all be familiar with. Jake, do you want to define monarchy for us?
Yeah, sure. So a monarch is... a head of state. Here's a slightly dry definition.
Well, a specific one, isn't it? Go on.
In a constitutional monarchy, the monarch's power... Oh my God. I can't believe I wrote this. In a constitutional monarchy, the monarch's power is subject to a constitution.
Wow.
In most current constitutional monarchies,
in hot soup. Hot soup constitutes soup that is hot.
Yeah, that's literally what I've just said. In most current constitutional monarchies, though, the monarch is basically a ceremonial figurehead of like national unity, state continuity, nominally sovereign, but through the legislature, exercises political sovereignty. So their political power is limited, is basically the point of all that.
So let's draw some distinctions. I mean, you threw out the term constitutional monarchy. So yeah, that's a monarch who's constrained by a constitution, written rules. It doesn't really explain what a monarch is. A monarch is basically a ruler or a sovereign of a specific territory. And generally their you know, being the monarch is a hereditary thing. So it's generally familial. It's passed down from family member to family member. So you can't earn it by some rule of, in fact, I mean,
you can't earn it.
You can't earn it in any way. In fact, I think, yeah, if it's anything other than hereditary, then it's not monarchy. It's just some sort of strange despotism.
I suppose, would that be some kind of aristocracy?
Yes, or something like that. Is there some other forms worth considering?
There are absolute forms of monarchy.
Yes.
Where you're
where
basically
monarchy is genuinely,
right?
You know, a god king. And is a dictator effectively. So, you know, during feudalism, that was very much the norm. No longer so. Nowadays, really, when we talk about monarchs, it's, as you mentioned, it's mostly symbolic figureheads. We'll get into this a bit, but, you know, part of the argument is effectively that they don't have power. We'll discuss the extent to which that's actually true. But the main thing is that it's a hereditary group of people who effectively lead the or are leaders of a country or sovereign. Had sovereign powers over a country.
Some examples of powers that they do still have and the queen still exercises include things like granting pardons, granting honors, so you get the queen's honors list, knighthoods, and then you have reserve powers such as she could in theory dismiss the prime minister, refuse to dissolve parliament or veto legislation. All of these are like sort of royal assent.
Yes, I mean all of those, but I would point out including royal pardons, there's a kind of de jure versus de facto, right? Like the queen, yes, that's true. And I think effectively, if someone is going to pardon someone, the queen is the person who does it. But, you know, the queen doesn't effectively just choose who to, or knows not to abuse that power. But, you know, having it and not abusing it doesn't mean it's not there.
It's the same as the knighted. She doesn't necessarily select the list. Yes, she's there with her sword, I imagine.
Yes, yeah, she's there with the sword. But, you know, I very much doubt it's the queen who's looking at the list of OBE, MBE submissions. Granted, do I think that she or other people in the monarchy can influence who's on that list? Like, de facto, yes. But yeah, it's despite what this says, it's not her sitting down saying, I really like Elton John's music. Let's. it makes my corgis very happy. Oh, no, that's not a very good Queen impression. We know what she sounds like. She's more gravelly.
Oh, really?
Oh, I can't do it.
Give me your best shot. What's a good Queen thing to say? We will meet
off
again.
With his head.
Oh, Philip.
Philip. Oh. Philip, look, I'm a stamp.
Is this not the most handsome 20p coin you've ever seen?
But we've talked a little bit about what monarchs are there.
There's some definitions. I think one final relevant bit of context before we get into debating this is we're talking specifically about the UK, I think, for today. It could apply to any monarchy. It doesn't have to be. But I think in terms of what we'll get into, we'll talk about the UK.
I think we're personally most interested in the UK, but it definitely applies. It
definitely applies more generally.
The specifics of certain policies will be very UK-centric, but I'm sure that there are corollaries in other. You mentioned there are 12 remaining functioning monarchs in Europe. I couldn't tell you who they are. Is it Spain's one of them, I think?
Spain, the Netherlands.
The Netherlands have a functioning monarchy.
Ooh, I think so.
What about Norway?
Yeah, I'm sure some of the Scandinavian countries. Yeah.
I know that Greece got rid of theirs. I know that Italy surely doesn't know. Italy's not had one for ever.
Not since at least like Mussolini, if not
before. Doesn't really count as a king though, does he?
No, it was around that time they got rid of it, if not before. I don't really know.
Not Austria. I have no idea.
Yeah. I'm sure we could get a list.
We'll leave that to you, the listener.
Yeah.
But Jake, really go ahead. UK focused.
What I was going to say was in the UK, one final relevant bit of context is that the movement to form a republic, which in practice would be the alternative to having a monarchy. And in that case, what you'd have is like a presidential head of state. You'd have an elected official
performing
that ceremonial function.
To clarify, France, for example, has this. A prime minister and a president, and you know France is pretty famous for not having monarchy anymore.
Yes.
For those who don't know, France killed its monarchy. So did Russia. So Queen, you watch out. I'm not calling for murder. I'm just saying that she should, you know, be treated like every other unemployed 80-year-old stuck in a council flat. That's horrible. But you know what I mean. I think it's unfair that we treat others is such a way, but true. Anyway, we'll come to this in the argument.
What was your point about France?
France has a president. I debate the point that we would have to elect such a ceremonial figure. Do you think that's true?
I think it's what the Republic movement wants. From looking into, they're literally called Republic, the guys in the UK.
Couldn't you just give Parliament and the Prime Minister a lot of these powers?
You could, although, to be fair, one of the arguments that monarchists make that even Republic seem to somewhat agree with is it's useful to separate the sort of ceremonial functions and the governmental functions.
It's a bit of a waste of time.
Yeah.
I mean, couldn't you also just scrap a lot of the ceremonial stuff? Or like not have a specific... So say, for example, knighting people, right? You can run a knighting ceremony without having a specific individual who is vested with the power of knighting people, right?
Just do it online.
you can run the entire ceremony and just have, you know, whichever dignitary happens to make sense at the time there as the person knighting. Like, do we really need, like, the official knighter? It's like, it makes sense to pay this person $10 million a year. They're the person who waves a sword over people's head. Like, I don't know. I guess that we'll come to this, but that's maybe one of the more interesting, relevant, like cultural arguments where there is maybe some benefit to it. I mean, it's part of what makes knighthood interesting.
Yeah. But what is interesting, and we definitely will touch on this as well, is that support for the monarchy has and remains quite high in the UK.
We're chatting about this. I'm curious to understand to what extent this is a status quo bias and support for the monarchy. I'm doing air quotes right now. Support
it depends how you frame the question, doesn't it?
Exactly.
It's like
saying, like, yeah, you want to abolish the monarchy. If your answer is no, that doesn't mean that you actively support the monarchy.
Yeah.
It just means that you might not be fussed enough to say that I want to abolish them.
Exactly.
So I wonder to what extent this 80% support is more of, you know, what percentage of that is like, actually, I'm highly ambivalent.
Yeah, I think you could fairly read that 20% wish to abolish the monarchy. I'm sure that I think
that's probably a more fair reading. And then, I mean, like, to flip that question around, how would these percentages change? As we said, if there wasn't a monarchy and someone was, or we had got rid of the monarchy, and the question was, should we reinstate a monarchy?
Yeah, it'd actually be interesting to see what the appetite for that would be in somewhere like France.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be horrendously low. It makes no sense. I mean, in France, who would you even appoint? I'm sure there's some.
How would you pick the family? How did it happen the first time?
A lottery.
But cool. I think that's all the context and definitions that we need. So before we get into breaking down the argument, something we quite like to do. I mean, you've made this clear, but Ant, what's your sort of, before we get into it, sense?
Okay, my high level answer.
Your high level answer.
Should we abolish monarchy? Yes. And I think my most fundamental point is that this is a very American argument, actually. So to our American listeners, I get why you did this. Like, we are, our fundamental principles generally as Western democracies are that people should be free and equal, right? Underline that second word. You know, de facto, are people actually always equal? No, but as writ by our law, and when considering our rights and our political privileges, that's, I think, one of the most important cornerstones of functioning Western democracies. And it's just funny that we keep this relic that completely defies that principle. And I think it would be a rather beautiful symbol to really say, as part, I mean, particularly, you know, take for example the recent Black Lives Matters movement and racism alleged by Meghan Markle. You know, it would be a very poignant symbol to say, to reaffirm equality in a society that's increasingly unequal, to remove people who are constitutionally, not practically, this is part of what we'll discuss, but not just practically privileged, but constitutionally privileged, as in they are a group of people who, as writ by our governmental laws, are given special privileges. Mm-hmm. You know, most people who get rich, you know, the way they got rich, anyone else is able to do, no one else is able to become a monarch, right? It's like, as writ by our law.
Yeah, it's exceptional.
Unless you marry a monarch. Unless you're damn sexy and into old ladies who have corgis.
Young bald men if you're Kate Middleton.
Yep. That's kind of my overriding principle. And there's a bunch of arguments for and against. But I feel like this is one of those ones where I think you can argue back and forth on the policy. But really, like, my fundamental view is they are a symbol that completely defies are fundamental principles of equality in the eyes of government.
That's very fair. I think you've put me in the unenviable position of having to argue against that, because I actually, I think my honest opinion is I am pretty mixed. I don't think I feel too strongly either way. I can see arguments for it. And I think, to be honest, the argument I feel most strongly about is just like, you mentioned status quo bias. And in practice, it does come down to some amount of that, like the practicality around disestablishing the monarchy, what you'd replace it with. We saw sort of how much like the country went through when we just dealt with Brexit, and it's more social upheaval to be throwing into
what
the mix.
We call it Quexit, getting rid of
the Queen.
Is your position one of ambivalence or one of being torn between two options?
More ambivalence, personally. Like emotionally, I feel ambivalent. There are positives I can see to the royal family. I think on the grounds of principle, I align with you, okay. But. Yeah, I can put that feeling aside for the rest of the episode and try and make the case against.
I also have another point. Okay,
yeah.
For those of you who've been listening to my dulcet tones for a while now, that was me leaning right into the mic for sexy voice time. You'll have noticed that I have a funny accent. It's part of the reason. It's not funny. I've internalized the way that people talk about me. That's like when people internalize like anyway. I don't have a funny accent. I have a slightly different accent to conventionally British people. So I moved around a lot. I'm the child of a first generation immigrant. And I feel like within that context, when I kind of reflect on, you know, my Britishness, I'm a British citizen, and my relationship with the nationality, I also think the monarchy in that context is just so much more confusing to me. In the same way that I find the notion of, you know, strong national identities so strange, because you know all you need to do is to take a genetic test for about 90% of people to realize that they're really not that far off some totally other national heritage, and it's it just all feels a bit arbitrary, right? So then to suddenly invest so much into this group of people who actually, you know, for me it, to some extent, are also a symbol of old England, right? It's almost a symbol of like how not British I am. It's a reminder that I can never be as British as they are, right?
I wonder how much that's a generational thing as well, though, yeah. Right?
Well, I mean, to be fair, you say generational thing, that as in you think it bothers old people.
I think I can see it being the case that older generations, I haven't seen the stats to sort of corroborate this, but it feels to me that older generations probably identify more strongly with that kind of monarchic tradition.
I think this feeling that I'm describing is part of why the whole Harry Meghan thing was so, because like the idea of, you know, a functioning monarch bringing in not just an American, but a American of a different race seems to, because I'm pointing at like this, aside from the equality thing, it's also the monarchy is a symbol of, you know, in what I think is the worst sense, what it means to be British, in that kind of, you want really white people who are really from here, which is you know, ironic considering the royal family is mostly German.
I'm as British as Queen Victoria. Yeah. You mean you're German, you're half German, you're married a German.
Which is so true. But I think that's part of what made the whole Meghan Markle thing so annoying to so many people, because it was like, no, this is our... I rule Britannia. Britannia rules the waves. We're white and we own the world. And then suddenly a black American woman is bringing a gospel choir to their wedding. That's a really long way of saying, personally, as someone who is British but doesn't strongly identify, like, would I, for example, ever, outside of wider circumstances where I thought the thing that I was fighting was wrong, like, do I feel particularly inclined to, like, quote-unquote, fight for my country? No, not particularly. I don't feel a strong affinity to this country over others. Like, I have two citizenships, and having moved around the world a bunch, I kind of understand that there's a lot of people in countries I have no relationship with who I have much more in common with than a lot of people in the UK. So it's weird that we have this symbol of what it means to be British.
It is interesting, because you mentioned Black Lives Matter earlier as well, and I think there was a lot of, I mean, that whole episode of toppling statues was a symbolic example of cutting ties with the past that we're increasingly ashamed of. Whereas a monarchy, it seems to be an aspect of a past that people still uphold some amount of pride around and
strange,
invest identity
right?
in. And it's that's why I comment about possibly it being a generational thing, is just that I feel like it's something our generation are, and maybe a large part of that is just internet access. Like, we've grown up with communication with other cultures and across the world. And
you're saying generational, and like, are you suggesting some people who grew up in the 1700s are still alive? No, I'm joking. I totally understand.
It's different. Growing up in our generation is very different to our parents, and
I can see that. And particularly grandparents. And I understand a stronger sense of national identity if you grew up in a time when the world was smaller, much fewer people ever traveled abroad, let alone, you know, had a life where they lived across five different countries on disparate corners of the planet. There were world wars that literally united people into like groups of nations and really created that strong sense of camaraderie.
Sense of human tribalism.
We're talking about time pre-globalization, basically, right?
Yeah.
Whereas now, like, you know what? There's probably kids in Ethiopia with internet access who I have a lot more in common with than probably half the UK population. And I know that. And I can go there and I can see them relatively easily, or we can catch up online. And I can find my community outside of national or geographic borders. Anyway, that was a ton of waffle.
So what do we think briefly? There's our not so brief high level. Let's get into this. There's a lot of different strands of argument, and I've tried to roughly put them in a sort of logical order. There's 9. I'll read them out just very quickly and then we'll dive right in. The arguments around 1, principles around democracy. 2, questions of like identity and history, as we talked about. 3, the royal family actually provide a lot of cultural entertainment. 4, questions around elitism, touched on that as well with Meghan Markle. 5, the cost, which is something a lot of people immediately go to. Like, you ask man on the street, what do you think about the royal family? And if they're in any way negatively inclined, they'll be like, cost, taxpayer money, that sort of thing. Corruption, though, lobbying and that sort of element of power that they have. 7 is their secrecy. 8 is their soft diplomacy and international relations. But then 9, finally, is the practical pain were we to dismantle them. So lots to talk about. Let's get right into it.
Yeah.
1, democracy. I think this is the biggest argument Republicans can make. And Anthony, I'll leave you to make this point.
I feel like we kind of talked about it a bunch before, right? The main thing is that fundamental argument around equality, right? And it's just completely undemocratic to have a family who, as writ by law, has special privileges.
And when you say undemocratic, is that purely because it's inherited, not elected?
Yes.
Or is there more to it than that?
Well, it's because they effectively have special rights. There is no other person who, by virtue of something other than an elected office, is streamed a really significant amount of money. And it's also relevant that this amount of money makes them some of the wealthiest people in the country, by the way, by virtue of, you know, our actual legislation. We're not just talking about you know, the fact that a lot of people draw this comparison to like rich people, like, oh, loads of people are born with rich parents. The difference is that anyone in the eyes of the law can become a rich parent. No one else can become a monarch. That's a fundamental, what's the word? Something that undermines? It fundamentally undermines democracy. It fundamentally undermines democratic principles.
And what is it specifically? Is it their wealth that undermines the principles or is it both? Is it wealth and the fact they're not elected?
It's not so much the wealth. The wealth just makes it quite so bitter.
Yeah, I thought maybe.
It's the fact that they literally have special rights written in to our legislation, right? Because our legislation is just a body in the UK. The legislation is a body of stuff that we've worked out over hundreds of years, beginning back when we had actual absolute monarchs and we had to negotiate power away from them. You know, the thing is, from this kind of perspective, not to be petty, but like from a philosophical democratic perspective, even if they had, you know, even if there were old redundant laws that gave them powers that were useless, I'd say we should remove them. Like, we shouldn't give certain people special powers. This is, or special rights that other people wouldn't. It's tantamount to saying some people are more important, or it fundamentally undermines the core principle of most Western democracies, which is equality in the eyes of the law.
I think that's very fair. I think the only counter I can really come up with to that is just, it doesn't really tackle the principle, but it is just to say that the role is such a ceremonial one that if we're concerned about political power, we will come to that. We'll talk about lobbying and influence. But I think in practice, it's not like they veto anything. It's not like they, you know, they become political blockers. They perform a ceremonial function, which possibly even allows for more political efficiency because they take all the sort of
stuff. The argument isn't about political efficiency. It's the fact that the role that they're providing is unelected and extremely highly paid, right? No position that is extremely highly paid by government should be an unelected position that people inherit hereditarily. No group of people should have special rights that other people don't have.
That does to some extent happen. You like lordships are passed down.
And that's a very good example of something that people really disliked and got rid of. It's hugely diminished. Let me confirm whether it's...
I feel like, to be fair, even making that argument, it's not a justification of why the royal should be the case to point out another problem.
Hereditary peers removed. House of Lords Act 1999. All you're doing is giving an example of something that people agree we should get rid of. So yes, nobody should have special rights. The only example that we can reasonably think of has been removed recently.
In which case, I mean, really, the only sort of counter, and again, it's not on the grounds of principle, is I suppose the follow-on argument, which is to talk about the sort of emotional attachment that people form with the royals and the history and identity.
Okay, so this is moving on to the next pillar.
I think this is moving on to the next argument, because
you can see that from the democratic perspective, it's kind of hard to argue that the monarchy,
I think so,
is a good thing.
I can't think of a good reason why you'd say this particular family is deserving of special privilege.
Yeah, or how that's worth maintaining to strengthen our democracy.
I mean, it's like you say, if you're talking about inheritance specifically, it's not like capitalism does a particularly great job of equalizing
But there's a difference, right? Anyone can build up capital to allow their children to inherit. Not anyone.
No one.
Yeah, no one. Unless you marry them, right? And I appreciate, like, as is often the case in capitalism, there's a big difference between actual equality that people have and the equality of opportunity that people have, right? The point is, anyone can be rich, no one can be a monarch, like we said quite a few times. The fact that some people are not born rich doesn't mean that their parents didn't have the ability to be rich. And ideally, we'd live in a perfectly fair society where, you know, people could fairly convert their will to work hard into, or I don't know, maybe that's relying too much on meritocracy, which is also a bit, you know.
Well, another
question for another day: is meritocracy a good thing? Next, history and identity.
Keeping my monarchist hat on, the biggest argument that they tend to make is around this: the British monarchy is hugely tied up with the country's history and identity. It's a big part of national heritage. It's everything that you described that you just hated in the introduction. But to abolish the monarchy would be to basically consign all of that to just being a historical curiosity and not have it continue to be an evolving part of our national identity.
So I'm going to put it out there, okay? And we were discussing this earlier. As a rule of thumb, if you are arguing for something and your argument is history, historical, cultural stuff, okay, you're on the wrong side. If that's your argument, if that's the pillar of your argument, like, rule of thumb, like, change your view.
Do you think tradition is necessarily a bad thing then?
Tradition isn't necessarily a bad thing, but you have to remember, traditions are things that we make up, right? And we should argue about the reasons around why certain traditions are worth maintaining. The fact that something is a tradition is not a reason to maintain it as a tradition, okay? Genital mutilation is a tradition, right? And slavery, to some extent, was a tradition. I don't know if that's fair to say, but, you know, if we're talking about history and identity, you know, a classic example would be the North-South fight in the US and people fighting over Confederate statues, you know, people who fought to maintain slavery and saying that this is, you know, offensive, and people saying, no, it's traditional, it's part of our history. And generally my view is that yes, tradition is a thing that exists, but tradition shouldn't exist for tradition's sake, because there's lots of examples of things that are horrible that we would maintain if the argument is that tradition should exist for tradition's sake.
So let's take a different example, because that's a fair point. But what if we take a look at traditions that generally we find sort of charming or appealing that seem to be relatively harmless?
But why do you find them? You just said traditions we find charming or appealing, right? The point is you're using some other criteria other than the fact that they're a tradition.
Oh, yes. But this is my point linking back to the monarchy, right?
Yeah.
The fact is...
So you're saying they might just be nice.
I'm saying the fact is people form an emotional attachment to them. It's not just about tradition for tradition's sake. It's about the fact that people form emotional bonds. I was going to use the example of Oxford traditions.
Yep.
So there's a bunch of, like...
Do you see how, so in this context where we have nine pillars, effectively all you're doing is appealing to another pillar. So say, for example, you might be appealing to the entertainment pillar, right? If you're saying, oh, it's nice and people find it fun and stuff, That's not arguing on the basis of history and identity. That's arguing on the basis of entertainment.
No, but arguing on the basis of identity is to argue on the basis of forming emotional bonds and like that sort of color that it gives.
Yeah.
Let's do the Oxford example quickly. There's a bunch of like archaic traditions that happen at all sorts of Oxford colleges. The one that we went to, you had to wear gowns to dinner every night, for example, which was annoying actually at different points. But I think generally it's something people consider harmless and somewhat charming, and it's been around and continues to be the case. I suppose it's similar to the fact that all the teachers and staff eat on the sort of high table and then look out over the sort of Hogwarts benches of other tables where everyone else eats. And you can possibly dig into the sort of nuances of that and make arguments. But by and large, those traditions stick around for years and years because why not? Like they're sort of fairly harmless. Is that tradition for tradition's sake in a negative way?
I feel like as you were describing there, you're describing feelings and things. Again, I still feel like you're effectively, all of these arguments is effectively coming back to just using other factors to determine what traditions are. Oh, that's a nice tradition, and that's, you know, that's an abhorrent tradition, right? None of the, like, if you're truly arguing tradition should be maintained for tradition's sake, okay, it could be a factor that could counteract some things, but you can't really be absolute about it. And even then, I feel like when we're arguing about the certain things that we want to maintain, it's more, there are other factors like entertainment that we seem to be getting from it. I kind of get what you're saying.
I'm definitely not arguing about tradition for tradition's sake. If anything, I'm arguing for the fact that traditions over time build up emotional resonance. And it's not to say that you're doing something for tradition's sake, but that becomes core part of what you're doing. And if you don't argument, I have very little else. That is the crux of the monarchists kind of.
I can kind of see the point. I can kind of see that, like, it forms some understanding of our shared history that identifies us, right? And that's kind of the kind of positive version of why people say, for example, we should maintain statues of people who did horrible things, right? Am I unfairly categorizing your argument as something that most people consider obviously abhorrent?
Yeah, nice of you to bring in like a really negative analogy.
So what you're saying is that slave owners should still have statues, Jake?
But the shared understanding of our historical
context.
Historical context, I guess, is a nice way of expressing it.
Yeah, okay, I guess it is something that is inherently valuable, but I consider a relatively low value, personally. I think culture and tradition changes, and there are things that are worth remembering, but we have to balance that against either more practical or more pressing principles. And, you know, as a rule of thumb, you know, there is a, I don't know whether this is, you know, because it's a good thing or just a, you know, a practical point, but like, if something is not harmful, it tends to survive. I don't know if it's because people are trying to maintain identity or because there's just resistance to like change. The status quo is, you know, the kind of baseline. Overall, history and identity, the truth is different people value different things differently. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some people listening to this who will identify very strongly British and see the monarchy as a symbol that's important to their identity and what it means to be British. I suppose the difficulty is just you can't argue to see eye to eye if you fundamentally value the different things in different ways, right? So say, for example, you don't particularly care about democracy, but you care a lot about your identity as a British person. Then it's very hard to bring you around to my argument. Like, we actually, you know, we're basically taking the same inputs but have a different function that's multiplying everything by different factors.
Yeah, it's about different value judgments in that case.
Yeah,
it's worth highlighting in this context of identity the importance of the Queen specifically.
She's well liked, but she's old, so she's literally a part of history.
I think if you sort of did some sort of associative test with like Britain, the word Britain,
mate.
And the Queen would be sort of top five.
I remember there was something. There was something on this. I can't give you the number. I'll double check it. But there's like a brand agency or consultancy, and they were saying that like the royal brand is one of the most powerful brands in the world, like one of the most valuable brands in the world. And absolutely, when, you know, if you went into Oklahoma, that's when I think of random America. Apparently, it's Oklahoma, maybe Kentucky, and you go and ask someone, you know, name three things that are British. I think the things they're going to name are like tea, the Queen. I don't even know what the third thing would be, but the first two would be tea and the Queen.
Football, maybe?
Football. Cricket. I don't know. Yeah. Tea, the Queen, and football.
Soccer. But yeah, I think the Queen specifically, it has, you know, her popularity has been pretty steady as a figurehead. And as a woman, I mean, apparently, according to Gallup, she ranks ahead of Oprah as the most admired woman of all time.
Wow, has she even done that much?
She's sat on a throne for a
very long time,
60 years plus.
She filled a very important ceremonial role.
And an interesting recent example, just talking about history, was obviously in the early days of the pandemic, the Queen did that lockdown speech. Do you remember watching it? Did you watch it?
This is me shaking my head for those who are listening.
So it's a rare thing for the Queen to do a speech not on Christmas Day. I think it's only ever happened 3 times in history.
I also don't watch that either, FYI.
Fair. That's funny, because that is a real British tradition again. I think, yeah, my family is one where, you know, that will be on every
Are
Christmas.
You saying that we're not British?
What's that?
Are you questioning my Britishness?
No.
I can question my Britishness. You can't question my Britishness.
But she did a rare speech when lockdowns first began. And I think it was something I think people
actually got quite... to say lockdown, you know, support lockdowns when she lives in the biggest house in the country.
Gets quite lonely in there, I imagine, if you're in lockdown.
I'm sure she still had her servants around.
She provides a real sense of like political stability, consistency.
Oh, well, isn't
I think.
That nice?
Yeah. Well, but this is my point. This is to sum up the identity.
Yes,
point,
it is.
Yes, it is nice. That's the way she's liked. Okay, cool. Talked a lot about that. It's actually fairly linked to the third point, although distinct. The third argument we made was around entertainment. That's distinct in the sense that it's not so much about like an emotional bond, so much as just providing like
fodder for the sun.
Yeah, for the tabloids. I suppose just something for people to enjoy. Like the monarchs have, like, as we said, we talked about them having quite high approval ratings. There's a poll that was done on specific monarchs. So the Queen and Prince William, the highest rated monarchs, they have like between 60 to 70% individual approval ratings. That drops quite a lot for the Queen's son, Charles, who's next in line to the throne. He's only on about 40%. And then Prince Andrew comes in at a shockingly low, not even shocking, shockingly high for him, 7%. I don't know who the 7% of people are who still approve of Prince Andrew, but there you go. The point being, anyway, whether you love or hate the monarchs, you really can't deny their entertainment value.
Can't I?
they provide a lot of news, a lot of like, I mean, a lot of the big sort of news moments in the last 20 years were, you know, the royal weddings, the royal babies, then you've got Prince Philip's death, but then you've got on the scandal side, you've got Diana, you've got Prince Andrew's revelations.
Didn't we literally give the example recently of how, at the beginning of this episode, of how Prince Philip's death overshadowed actually much more important news?
I think so.
Is this not a good example of nonsense? I mean, is this basically Big Brother before Big Brother? We've just taken a family, put them on the public stage, and we just watch them and throw tomatoes at them when we're not happy with them. One, is that fair on them as individuals? Another way that actually the democratic argument could be flipped around, yep, maybe they don't have special privileges. Maybe they have a special curse.
I think a lot of people would agree with that.
Yep. And, you know, is that entertainment worth their potential suffering? And two, you know, do I think that some amount of entertainment makes it worth undermining our democratic principles? Absolutely not. Are they even that entertaining? Think about how much we spend on them. Think about what we could do with that money if entertainment is our goal.
They do. I mean, we'll come to the money point. They obviously bring in a lot of money as well. So I think...
Debate that. We'll debate it in a minute.
We will. You talked about Prince Philip. You're right. We did say, but I think that's a question of value judgments again. I think there were a lot of people for whom it was sort of fairly significant news.
Oh, really? Because they knew him really well.
Personally, deeply, intimately. And yeah, I mean, the fact that The Crown is one of the most popular TV shows, again, probably just...
So, okay, so your argument is we should maintain a deeply unfair historical political system for purely ceremonial reasons at huge expense that actually undermines democratic principles, because then Netflix could do a good series about it.
And people will watch it.
Yeah. Jake, that's a bit like me saying I should murder you in a really weird way so that Netflix makes a really good series about it.
You heard it here first, guys.
He goes missing. We know what happened.
I agree. I think personally, when you contrast the sort of principles of democracy with the value of like entertainment, it's irrelevant.
It pales.
It does rather pale.
I mean, to be fair... I don't want to use this argument because I kind of disagree with it. But I mean, if you think about it in context of, say, for example, lockdown, it's made very clear that entertainment is a very low priority on the pecking order of important things that we need to try and protect, right? Because it was, you know, it was basically the thing that like everything, you know, health, freedoms, etc., all of that, you know, we're basically giving up entertainment. Effect. Oh my! I'm on my hangover brain. Sorry, guys.
You make that point, but then at the same time, if you look wait,
articulate the point for me.
you're just saying, like, in terms of
the hierarchy of needs that we
societal sort of values and yeah, like lockdown made actually fairly explicit the way that
entertainment is a frivolous thing,
goods, right? And entertainment was low down beneath public health and education and a bunch of other things that I think conventionally people would say it is less important.
Opening nightclubs is a low priority.
Right. But then if you actually look at sort of how people vote with their feet in the sense of what they spend money on during lockdown, actually entertainment spending soared in terms of available goods. Forms of entertainment. Yeah. Like you've got your Netflix subscriptions. Football was paused and actually it was something they kept going professional like sports in the second round of lockdowns because they were like, actually the value of providing this opiate of the masses to the masses is probably
people want their fix, man.
Yeah. And I think again it's a weak argument.
Sorry, is your argument that opiate for the masses is a good thing?
Yes.
You keep cornering yourself into weird positions, man.
I realize
opiate for the masses is intended as a bad thing, right?
Oh, I know. I'm saying in this context, personally, I think it's sort of it's a weak point comparatively to the principle of sort of democracy and fairness, but entertainment does have meaningful value to a lot of people and it provides a lot of income.
Anyway, next one.
Next
elitism.
One. Yeah.
I feel like this overlaps a little bit with the democratic point. We talked about how, you know, there is a kind of preferential elitism there. Is the point here more around class and kind of soft elitism?
It's a point you kind of already made. In the democratic point, I think the crucial factor is they're unelected. In the elitism point, I think the crucial factor is
they're unelected and they receive certain benefits.
And they receive benefits. And in this case, it's the fact that they're born into privilege and power and it sets a bad precedent for how we value things in society.
Right.
The fact that this upper rung exists that's unattainable for the vast majority of people.
So if we selected a random... Okay, so if we got rid of the monarchy... And we selected a random family and we didn't pay them particularly much. You know, we paid them 50K a year or whatever. And they did the ceremonial stuff. Then, sorry, I'm creating a very convoluted example to say.
Are you trying to distinguish the two?
Yeah. So then a Republican might say this is still a democratic issue because it's unelected, but it's no longer an elitist issue because they're not ridiculously wealthy and they're not huge landowners as some hangover from a feudal system that for some reason, you know, just by virtue of the fact that we didn't happen to have guillotines like the French choose to kill our monarchy when the French did, we've allowed this family to like nominally own like a quarter of the country or something stupid.
They do own a ridiculous amount of land.
Yeah.
That's true.
But so yes, it's kind of using that as two separate strands. Like if we basically got rid of the royal endowment, then the elitist argument might not matter anymore.
It would depend on the process by which the family was elected. If it was literally a random lottery, as you say, then that would also... Would that still be an elitist issue?
No. If it's a random lottery every year...
The process is around
no.
democracy and the sort of resulting privileged outcome is around elitism. I mean, the counter to the elitism point is the one that you already made around the fact that I think actually a lot of people wouldn't choose to be born into this role. We sort of set it out. We describe it in such a way of sort of power and privilege as like, you know, the sort of upper rung of society. But I don't think it's particularly desirable.
That is the weakest argument. You know, you know who you are? You are Kylie Jenner, like posting like, oh my God, I'm so sad. And sorry, I'm not invalidating the fact that like people like that can't be sad. But I do also think that if you think that your problems, like even if you're having genuine mental health problems, if you think that your problems are seriously anything to think of on the scale of, you know, people living in countries where, you know, their parents are killed as part of a genocide and they're raped as children and stuff. If you lack the awareness and context to realize that you are, you know, you're pretty good.
It's this aimed at Meghan Markle?
Sorry?
Is this aimed at Meghan Markle?
Why?
It sounds like...
Oh, because she... I actually forgot that. That she was saying like, oh, I was very upset. It's... Yeah, I think it was... What's it? It's a little bit tone deaf of her, right? Like, those are legitimate concerns and I get it. It wasn't intended at her, but now reflecting on it, I remember what you're talking about. Yeah, it's a little tone deaf. I feel like those are legitimate and those are issues that are worth considering. And like you should you know, fair enough, voice them, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you should also take, you know, keep a little bit of context. Remember that half the people who are reading about this, you know, I mean, in the UK, a lot of people are living in genuine poverty, let alone tons of people around the world who don't have bloody drinking water. And your sister-in-law was mean to you before your wedding. And like, you know, maybe you felt seriously mentally disturbed by that. And that's, you know, by all means, you should get help. But please keep some context, right? Like that there are people in Myanmar whose villages, their entire worlds are being burnt and raped. And you're taking up headlines talking like, I felt suicidal. And I'm not undermining the fact that you felt suicidal and it's legit, but context.
Well, I think it's true. And especially when it happened, which was sort of during most like Western countries were in lockdowns, and you've got sort of issues like climate change sort of that could be taking up more space in the public agenda.
It just makes me think of those. It makes me think of those celebrities who were singing in their mansions like, oh, we're all together, whatever.
We'll get through this.
And you don't know the struggles. Like, you might even be unhappy, and I appreciate that. And I'm not saying that you're not allowed to not be happy because you're rich, but like, don't act like you know what it's like to struggle.
Let's move on. That's elitism.
Sorry, I have another one.
Go on.
On the elitism point, and this is, I mentioned, is this intended as a soft point? The UK, ask anyone who's not really from the UK, classism here is a strange thing, right?
It is.
Because I also think, in terms of class in the UK, class, in terms of working class, middle class, upper class, in the US, I think that that is largely determined by wealth. Right. Maybe the US arguably doesn't even have an upper class. There's some families who are like kind of like effective monarchies, like the Kennedys or the Clintons and stuff like that.
Sure. Which is more political, really.
Yeah. But they're political. They're not, and it's not, you know, it's hereditary, but it's a familial reputation and it's money. It's not something enshrined in the law, right? But in the UK, and I wonder if you think this is fair. No matter how much money you make or have, it doesn't make you upper class, right? Being upper class in the UK is about titles and it's about proximity to the throne, right? Yeah. So when I think of upper class people in England, you don't even need to particularly be super, super wealthy, but, you know, generally you'll be in some way related to a duke or in some way related to a lordship, and you'll, you know, either be close to or maybe even literally related to someone who's tangentially part of, you know, you might be like a thousandth in line for the throne or something. Do you get what I'm trying to say there? That like,
I do.
The monarchy is the symbol of the class system in the UK.
Yeah, which is specifically, you're talking about the upper classes, right?
Like yes. I think the funny thing is there's lots of very, very rich middle class people who aren't upper class, and a lot of upper class people who aren't particularly wealthy anymore. Their family probably was at some point. But, you know, by virtue of being, say, a duke or lord related to one, they're actually still nominally upper class.
Yeah.
They have a crest, for example, things like that.
Yeah, family crests. No, it's strange. It is unique. It's a funny thing. And class in general is, I guess, a strangely pervasive thing in the UK. It's something that British people are just quite aware of. And it's probably determined mostly by like where you live, work, and went to school than anything else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, they're a symbol of that. And I don't think it's a particularly good thing. I mean, that's a very normative statement. But like, generally, I think people think negatively of the class system. Like, again, it undermines the principle that people are actually equal and should be equal.
I can't imagine it makes anyone particularly happy.
Well, except for people who are at the top.
And even then, I mean, it's that whole economic argument around the fact that actually inequality is bad even for the people at the top because it creates conditions of crime and...
Yeah, in the mid to long term. So, you know, instability is not good for anyone in the mid to long term, and inequality creates instability. Wow. Okay. Well, this takes us on to the next point, costs and corruption.
Costs and corruption. There's a few different corruption arguments, and let's start with the cost, the financial one. Corruption, I guess, should be understood as abusing public office for personal gain. Now, we'll come to that. The cost of the monarchy is actually kind of a complicated thing. I've been trying to make sense of it this morning, and I haven't really succeeded because it's a weird split of public and private money that flows in. The royal family's total assets exceed 28 billion, most of which is the crown estate and then various palaces. Yes.
I want to say a fundamental thing first, right?
Yeah, for it.
Your view on the finances of the monarchy depends very much on a specific thing, which is, I think a lot of people who are anti-monarchy, or at least I am one of those people, you know, saying we shouldn't have a monarchy is not synonymous with saying, you know, oh, we should get rid of them out of their ceremonial position and they should keep all of the royal wealth, right? I think a lot of people, by implication, kind of synonymously mean like, you know, these are, you know, they're owning all of this stuff is just a hangover from feudalism. And like, obviously it's ridiculous. Like, do we think that we should just turn them into a regular family who owns 28 billion worth of stuff? Like, I think most of us would argue that like, that shouldn't be the case. The difficulty is, you know, there are plenty of people who, or there's a lot of people who, if you go far enough back, have, you know, are rich now because of ill-gotten gains hundreds of years ago. But the fact that you can't rectify all of them is not a reason to maintain it in this specific circumstance. So
yeah, that's
a little fallacy. But like, so all of this cost argument, right, has to be taken in that context. Because if you take it in that context, then I, like, say, for example, I think the royal endowment shouldn't be owned by the royal family, right? Because that's, like I said, it's hangover from feudalism. That means that the cost is at least 28 billion worth of assets, because that's what the royal estate is worth. The crown
estate. In practice, it's slightly different to that. The crown estate is worth a lot of that, 28 billion. It's actually, the queen sort of runs it, but she doesn't run it, but she sort of sits above it. But the crown only receives 25% of the profits.
Oh, only 25% of profits on 28 billion.
But the rest goes back into the treasury, right?
No.
Point. The rest goes into taxpayer funds.
But the point is, they own it, and the agreement that they made with Parliament however many hundred years ago was that they give 75% of the profits, right? Mm-hmm. First of all, it's tantamount to the billionaire argument. It's like, oh, Bill Gates gives a lot away. Like, there still shouldn't be a situation where someone has tens of billions, and even if they give half of it away, they still have tens of billions, right? Mm-hmm. It's still wrong. That's one. And two, the point is, those are their assets, right? It's not that the government owns this and is giving them 20%, 25%. It's that the queen and the royal family own it, and they're giving the government 75%. Those are very distinct things. Right, because
I'm actually not sure that's true.
No, because then if you think about removing the monarchy ceremonially, one means the government keeps the royal estate and doesn't have to pay them the 25% anymore. The other means that the queen takes it and doesn't have to pay the government 75%.
No, but I think it's the latter. I think the crown estate actually is basically run by the treasury.
And no. I think it's actually owned quote unquote by the royal family.
I think they like chair it or something, but I don't think. I don't know.
So wait, are you agreeing that removing the monarchy is synonymous with also capturing the royal estate?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, that's the way it should be.
Right. Because I've seen, the reason I say this, I was watching some videos on it, and some people were not taking that as synonymous. And they were basically saying, if we got rid of the royal family, we wouldn't get the 75% of profits. And I was like, No.
What would happen to Buckingham Palace?
I invite you to revise what happened in the French Revolution.
Generally, it seems to be that taxpayer expense or money that comes from taxpayers to fund the royal family is sort of hovers between 30 and sort of 60, 70 million a year. It's higher at the moment because Buckingham Palace is undergoing major upkeep.
Yeah, which is something that we would have to fund whether they were living there or not. Or actually, I don't know if that's true. Maybe it would be lower.
Yeah. What that means is it costs the average taxpayer. Well, it's gone from costing the average taxpayer about 65p per year to more like sort of £1.30.
I hate framing it that way because that makes it sound little. Like, yes. If I could use that argument, be like, well, it's just one. You know, if just everyone in the country gave me one penny, no one would miss that one penny. That's a terrible reason for everyone to give me one penny.
But suddenly you'd have like, 600K or whatever.
Yeah, that's a horrible, like, just because it sounds small spread over lots of people doesn't mean it's good. What we should really be talking about is the opportunity cost of what that could be spent on. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea of, I don't know, some way of putting 60 million into the context of how the government could spend that?
Well, it could have funded the Garden Bridge.
What's that?
That project that Boris botched and wasted £50 million on. Mm. It could have funded...
Let's put a tiny fraction
of test and trace.
Let's put it like this, right? Let's say the government is supporting people. It was up to £2,000, right, for the furlough scheme.
£2,500.
It was up to £2,500, right? So 60 million over 12. No, over 2,500.
Over 12.
Over 12. It could have supported. Yeah, so it could have supported 2,000 people for a year, and instead we support about five.
or however big the family goes. But yeah,
no, true. All interesting.
An interesting caveat, because I think it's funny. A lot of people, as we mentioned, bring up the cost argument. One of the first things people's minds go to, especially if they're kind of a little bit on the fence, is like, well, the royal family bring in a lot of tourism receipts.
I hate that argument.
Well, hold on a second. But they also cost the taxpayer some amount of money. So, but what if they were to net out neutral? I think if you're a diehard Republican, it wouldn't even matter if they were like net profitable. It's the fact that they have this opportunity to receive these funds and this, yep. like,
I mean, if there was some way that I could pervert our democracy, you know, the argument, I think most people taking it as the status quo that it's not the case. If someone brought forward some way that we could pervert our democracy and they made the argument, oh, and it would make us some money, I would hope most people would say that doesn't mean we should do it, right? That's one. Two, I don't think that's true, okay? Classic example, treaty, Palace of Versailles, right? Lots of people basically, when they make these estimates, they're such nonsense. It's all like, oh, the number of people who come to visit Buckingham Palace, right? One, Treaty of Versailles hasn't had a living monarch for many centuries. I can't recall exactly when that's 200 centuries, two centuries, sorry. Doesn't stop people visiting, okay? And then two, actually, when you don't have acting monarchs, it actually makes it easier for people to visit, right? Because it means that you can give people more access more often because it's never being used.
Yeah, it's quite funny.
Right? So I hate the reasoning around that, right? It's a total fallacy. Like, have you or anyone you know ever based your decision to visit somewhere and visit their historical sites on whether their monarchy was still functioning or not?
Well, you say that, but actually there are a lot of significant ceremonies that wouldn't necessarily still happen. I suppose you could argue they could still do the changing of the guards and the Queen's Jubilee. Well, they couldn't do the Queen's Jubilee, but they could do things like the changing of the guards and stuff without a monarch, but it wouldn't really have the same flavor.
It wouldn't have the same flavor. Basically, I just wanted to point out that I think a lot of the reasoning around that is often flawed. It's not as clear as people make it sound. There's a lot of arguments as to why the sites would be more accessible and do just as well without acting monarchs. Well, maybe it has some benefit. It's not been substantiated enough to really convince me.
My personal view is I think the finances are actually somewhat irrelevant. And the fact that they probably net cost the country money is problematic. But I think even were they to bring in a lot of money, it's sort of irrelevant to the risk that they have access to like funds that they don't necessarily deserve, and there's scope for corruption there. But moreover, the democratic point that we made.
I mean, imagine if we enshrined it in the UK's government that they gave us £1 million a year to just work in tech startup stuff, and like maybe we return a positive return on the money. Most people would still say that's a horrible policy. It's a horribly unfair, ridiculous policy. Especially if we then turn it into a hereditary forever thing.
All future colleges.
And the main thing is, as well, aside from whatever stipends we give for their security or direct payments to them, again, if we were to dissolve the monarchy, we would effectively get to take the royal, the crown estate, and the remaining 25% of profits on it that we do not get to access.
It's crazy and how much of that are like properties and farms and things that actually turn over a significant amount of rent.
So much of it is land, which is the real thing that kind of kicks you in the teeth and says like, this is literally a hangover from the feudal system that we've just not bothered like actually dealing with in a mature way.
Now, on the theme of corruption, there's another form of it, which actually I find slightly more concerning. People tend to like making the argument that monarchs only have symbolic power. For example, the Queen's assent, her ability to block bills. The last time royal assent wasn't granted was in 1708, which was something to do with like a Scottish militia bill. But that, I think, is a really misleading sort of anecdote to the fact that they sort of don't really have power. Because actually, in practice, I think they have an awful lot of power. They have direct and privileged access to literally every member of government, particularly ministers. They can lobby them to get their views heard in a way that ordinary citizens just can't. Like, if you tried to go to, I don't know, Michael Gove, get him to do something, compared with Prince Charles having the same conversation.
I guess, is this coming back to that elitism thing? Because I guess there's another overlap here where, again, you could kind of make that like, oh, a billionaire kind of has that same position in a way.
He kind of does,
but a billionaire, you know, if you're being a perfect capitalist, has quote unquote earned that position. Whereas Charles is born into that position by virtue of our actual governmental policies.
Well, Charles, I'm glad you brought up, because I think he's actually the key point. And the guys who run Republic seem to really have it in for Charles in a way that, like, I haven't heard them talk about the Queen abusing this power necessarily.
But Charles had that whole expose where he'd been writing ministers, and he's not supposed to do that without, well, it's not a requirement, but, you know, in the interest of trying to look transparent, they're supposed to not do that and not share anything that's been written. Mm. And it turned out he had this whole trove of private letters he'd been sending to ministers to try and influence policy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And several examples of it actually being carried out. So in Cornwall, where he's the Duke, he'd vetted laws that prevented residents from buying their own estates because he owned the property and it was sort of feeding him rent. And there were supposed to be provisions that people could start to buy their own properties, and that's just been blocked and sort of shoved shunted aside for years and years. The other thing I think that becomes problematic, though, and I remember when I very briefly like interned in government, I noticed there was a sort of shift in ministers and people started being like, okay, we need to account for policy because this new minister likes things a certain way. And like, what I'm trying to say is there's a kind of implicit power that comes from just being in that position, that Charles just being on the scene, people know what they need to do to get Charles's approval or not. Mm. They know the kind of things that he's not going to like, and it actually just his presence affects the way things are designed.
It's a bit like your I'll give you a trivial example that plays into the like stereotypes. If someone has a partner, right, they might feel, this is the trope of, you know, someone going to the pub and their partner being like, why are you doing that, right? Sometimes the partner doesn't need to say it in order for you to feel the pressure of not to do. To clarify, I'm not talking about my own situation. I'm actually just thinking about trope. But like, you know, someone doesn't need to explicitly say, don't do that, to make you feel that you shouldn't do it.
Exactly that.
And, you know, actually another example that we hadn't discussed before, but how does lobbying and corruption or you know, abuse of power play into the Prince Andrew situation with Epstein, right? And yeah. both first of all, the fact that he was able to do those things for such a long period, you know, basically molesting young women and assaulting them, and then secondly, to evade capture, despite the fact that he's a well-known public figure who, you know, we know where he is. He's done public things. Like it's not like Ghislaine Maxwell, where like she was hiding away. We don't know where he is. He's just being kind of covered.
Yeah, we met Prince Andrew. I assume we're talking about Andrew there or Epstein.
Andrew.
Yeah.
Andrew.
Yeah.
Yes, we did meet. I shaked his very sweaty hand once.
Well, I thought it was distinctly not sweaty. Surprisingly dry.
Yeah, but I mean, is that another good example of how someone in the royal family has used their position abused their position to then molest young women, and is now abusing their position to evade facing any sort of accountability for it,
and certainly to protect Epstein, his friend, or yeah, whatever the details were there.
So that's, sure. I suppose that's another good example. And then, to be fair, I don't know. There's a soft diplomacy point later. I was going to flip it around to like, could this soft power be a good thing? But yeah, overall, I mean, to be honest, in the context of the wider stuff, where it's like, oh, they're filling a ceremonial role, blah blah blah, it's difficult because it's hard to be that high profile and not have some slip ups, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you could be totally well-meaning and your presence could still impact other people's policy decisions. But I also think that there's a lot of specific evidence of specific abuses, like intentional abuse of power.
Yeah, I suppose the only legitimate counter is this happens in regular politics anyway, with elected officials.
Yeah, but that's the crucial difference.
That is the crucial difference, exactly. The fact that they're unelected and interfering, in Charles's case, is the problem. You mentioned Andrew and we've talked a little bit about sort of Charles, and actually that links to the seventh strand, which is secrecy. I learned something new for the first time today. The royal family is exempt from freedom of information requests.
Well, you know, someone who were paying, a group of people who were paying 60 million, i.e. they're therefore in service of the country, really should have to provide information on what they're doing, right?
It's weird. I think the only other sort of like governmental or political functions, I don't know what the right sort of adjective is there, but the only other examples of where that doesn't happen are like the Secret Service, like literally.
And even they,
MI5, GCHQ, yeah, they have sort of exemptions around freedom of information.
And even they, you say that, they have rules around it.
They do, yeah.
But I mean, I don't want to just assume it's the same as the US, but I know in the US, like, there's a time period on it, but eventually you can see, and I know that there's, you know, every now and then there's like a bombshell thing of something that happened 20 or 30 years ago.
It gets made into a movie.
yeah. So like that expires, right? There's a certain amount because of the time sensitivity, but like it will eventually be public knowledge. Whereas this is like, they literally don't ever have to tell you things.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of the sort of information that someone might want to request that they don't have to provide?
Literally anything. They completely, you could, I don't know.
Okay, so you could, so for example,
you can't make a request to the royal family. You can't.
So I could normally say, for example, I'm worried that a minister is being frivolous. I could say, I want to see receipts of his costings for X trip, right?
Yeah.
We couldn't see that for the royal family. We couldn't be like, how much did it cost for the Queen or Prince William and Kate to go to blah? You know, yep. What were they eating on the way there? You know, were they being excessively frivolous, et cetera, et cetera? We can't do that.
I believe not.
That's horrible. Because then there's no accountability, right?
And the accountability is absolutely the key point, and it will link to the next one. But I think it's problematic in the context of the general conduct and the scandals like Harry and Meghan, Prince Andrew, Diana, various different attempts to sort of cover up dark stories within the palace. I think this secrecy, you could make the case that it's a matter of sort of security and privacy, and it's not necessarily people's business.
Well, but yeah, this again,
funneling so much sort of taxpayer money into it, and when they're performing a national function, you'd think there's
it's that awkward position again where like I really don't want to feel bad for a bunch of people who were paying 60 million. You know, like it's in many ways a rather enviable position, but it does remind you of the ways in which it's not enviable, because you mentioned they want their privacy, right? I kind of get that pull between like, this is a private, you know, this is a human being who's been put in this weird position, and, you know, it'd be nice if their whole life wasn't under direct scrutiny. I get that. But on the other hand, like I just said, in the, you know, give the example of like Will and Kate going to a specific country, like, would it be good for there to be some oversight to make sure that they're not, you know, spending taxpayer money ridiculously luxuriously and excessively? Like, yeah, that's how we treat our elected officials. Like, why wouldn't we treat someone who's on a foreign diplomacy trip the same way?
Yeah, why would you not hold them to similar standards?
I'm not saying I want to have a recording of their conversations.
Very fair. So now, the big point, soft diplomacy, which we've kind of pointed to in a couple of different ways here.
This is probably the strongest counter that I feel is like, okay, that makes some sense.
It's interesting because I think it still falls victim to the same principle of not being elected, right? But I suppose speaking to that sort of point about heritage and history and tradition, because of all those things, the royal family has a huge influence on international affairs and politics.
It's interesting how some countries have superpowers, right? So the rules don't apply to them in the same way, right? The US, for example, has the greenback, you know, has the dollar, which is effectively, because of the way we restructured the global economy after the Second World War, they have effectively the world's reserve currency. Right. And that gives them some economic superpowers. Right. Norway has a ridiculously large oil endowment that they've turned into a national sovereign fund, which, you know, gives them some superpowers.
China manufactures all the world's goods. Yeah.
But the UK's superpower in terms of, you know, international politics, is probably the royal family.
It's a little great grandma with a corgi.
Yeah. It's the thing that, like, because of the weird circumstances of the world, we somehow have something that other people can't replicate and gives us quite a lot of power.
And it really does. I mean, the Queen and all the other royal officials make a ridiculous number of international and national engagements every year. And it's amazing in the age of sort of influencers and celebrity media that we live through that they're still like next level. They just have so much.
I mean, how many people in the world would you say it's like, it's an assumption that they would spend time with the American press, like be able to like at a whim, not at a whim, but you know what I mean? Like very easily book a meeting with the American president or a call with the president of America. We're talking about literally a handful of people in the world. It's like Jeff Bezos, the Queen, and Xi Jinping.
Yeah. I still think the trouble with this is exactly as before. If it's not aligned with the will of the people and these are unelected officials, then it has the potential to be hugely negative. So the Queen has proven to be very dutiful, consistent, and so stable.
So the difficult thing with this one is, right, this is just it's a practical point, right? Like you say, they're unelected officials, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't work if it's not the real royal family, right? Like you can't elect someone to be our ceremonial dignitaries and expect people to treat them the way they treat the royal family.
Yeah. If we got a new president, for example, it would not have anything like the same influence. Well, it would have influence, but
it wouldn't have the same influence as the royal family.
No.
Who, in a strange way as well, actually the disconnection from government is maybe part of what makes them like actually so potent as a soft diplomat. Yeah, I mean, okay, imagine if, you know, you send over the Queen to Australia, for example, right? And it's, oh, Commonwealth, they nominally are a Queen, et cetera, right? Whereas if it was a president, do you not think that that would almost feel kind of like too starkly imperial, too like, wait, you don't actually have political power over us, whereas the Queen is a figurehead detached from government? Do you see what I mean? Do you think that that's... Do you think
that
someone like New Zealand or Australia would find it much more uncomfortable welcoming the, you know, UK's president as their nominal head of state rather than the Queen?
Yeah. I think so.
So you would defend, you just lose that. You can't elect someone into that position and maintain the soft power.
I think that's fair. I think that's true.
Oh, man. This in the context of, I mean, all my stuff about democracy, et cetera, is internal. But as I've mentioned before, my view on international relations is generally what is defined as realism, in that, like, I assume that countries are generally competing for power. They are not in the same way that people are, like, you know, countries don't function like people, and they're not like, oh, fundamentally good and we can all join together. I think a lot of projects like the UN do more for political theater than they do for like real effective change. And you see that anytime that, like, I don't know, China does something wrong, like, actually we can't deal with it, like, and in that context I am kind of like, oh, do we want to give up our international diplomacy superpower?
It's a fair thing to be concerned about, but would you still feel the same were the Queen to pass away and Charles to take the throne?
Oh my goodness, yeah, that's, I mean, this is the difficulty, is that as well it's highly dependent, and it kind of comes, it's kind of like the analogy of the benevolent dictator, right? If you have a benevolent dictator and they do even a decent job, it could kind of make you like, this dictator is pretty great, and maybe that's our superpower. We don't need to waste time with the bureaucracy of government, right?
Yeah,
it takes a bad dictator for you to realize, oh, this is why it's bad. This is why the bureaucracy is kind of good. It's a check and balance. Because, I mean, like, the extreme danger, and Charles has shown himself to be more willing to do this, to inject his personal view. You know, when the Queen goes somewhere, I think it's kind of quietly understood that, you know, the government will kind of have a chat with the monarchy or whichever member of the monarchy is going and be like, look, these are our goals. And as our representative, be aware of that. Maybe even they instruct them. But, you know, what happens when that middle person has the freedom to kind of inject what they want there? And to imply, you know, what the UK government would like, kind of how they would like it to appear.
It links to a point I read this morning around a point in favor of monarchs is that they are somewhat trained from birth to realize they have this sort of special power and the associated moral duty that comes with it. So
that's not to say that they have a special power personally. A lot of them are bad at it. It's that they're invested. Special power. Case in point, Harry, terrible statesman. If I had to think of someone to give an inspiring speech, he would be pretty far at the back of the line. I would rather the monarch from the King's Speech at the beginning of the movie.
What, before he went through voice coaching?
While he was a stutterer.
And then the reason I brought up Charles is because I think the fundamental question is one of accountability. But the point there at the end about sort of being raised with this sort of birthright is that you get trained in the fact that you have a sort of duty to, well, the crown, apparently, in the TV show, duty to the crown.
I haven't even seen it, mate.
Duty to your state or something. The question, as ever, remains, if you're unelected, who are you accountable to? So lastly, Anthony, we've talked about all the different arguments apart from one, which I mentioned at the beginning was possibly the thing that most strongly swayed me in favor of not abolishing the monarchy. And that would be the actual sort of practical pain of going through the process, considering the context that so many people approve of them.
Shut up.
Do you think people have an appetite for that kind of social upheaval?
Do I think people have an appetite for it? No. Do I personally see this as a reason not to do it? No.
Why not?
Well, for one, there's a huge financial pot at the end of it. The crown estate, right?
Yeah,
and the money that
you just want to get your grubby hands on the crown estate.
Dude, we entered a 6-year negotiation for $350 million a week You think that we can't kick an old lady out of a house for $60 million a year?
I appreciate the Brexit sarcasm there.
I appreciate that, like, it's non-trivial. Like, it will take a lot of, it would actually take probably, you know, months of negotiating back and forth. And, you know, it would take significant political willpower just to confiscate the Crown Estate, for example. It's an annoying relic, but, you know, we now have modern property laws that they have managed to enshrine this under. So it might be hard to do that. Granted, with the sovereign, we can do it, you know, Parliament is sovereign and can do it at once. But, you know, there may be limits to that and there could be a lot of arguing over it.
I have a case, and this possibly is actually my kind of concluding view, which is, given the sort of practical concerns around this, is there not an argument to be made that we just slowly, piece by piece, strip away the undesirable elements of monarchy?
Are you suggesting that we kill Prince Charles?
Start with Prince Andrew.
Yes, send Prince Andrew to jail.
So it never quite addresses that.
I mean, is that not effectively what we're doing over the course of 100 years anyway?
Well, I feel like that's why we've ended up in the situation we are in insofar as we've gone from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional one, to one that's largely ceremonial. And there are still problems, and we've talked about the Crown Estate, and there are things that we can do to mitigate that. But you could potentially end up in a sort of compromise situation where you've got the soft diplomacy benefits of a monarchy. You can try and strip away the sort of negative elitist aspects.
I get you, but like, one... Since a lot of these arguments are symbolic, the equality, the elitism, etc.
It's on the grounds of principle more than anything else,
yeah,
right?
If it comes down to principle, so you need to make a stand, one. Two, what happens when you reach the point where it's a comfortable stasis, where further change is like, this is no longer that interesting, etc. Like, you risk not fully rooting the problem.
I think is possibly where we are.
Yeah, we've basically reached the point where it's like, well, everyone's like, well, they're just ceremonial and like, okay, in the context of the national budget, $60 million is not that much. And like, yes, they own the Crown Estate, but we get most of the profit from it. And they're like, then they have soft power. And then we just kind of like, meh.
But this is why I think possibly a more sort of iterative, small steps approach might be the way to do it. Just try and push through sort of little power grabs piece by piece.
I don't know. That assumes that we need to agree that that's something we're working towards in order for that to happen, which isn't necessarily the case.
And I suppose the daunting thing about that is, if you were to do that, you'd basically be sort of saying, we ultimately want to get rid of you, but that's a big scary change that people don't have appetite for. So you'd kind of need to be a bit cunning about the way you went about it.
So yeah, I guess it's a way of alleviating the whole practical pain part, like saying like, okay, it could happen over a long period. But I can also see the practical pain point does risk you getting stuck in what we would, you know, what we might call like a local maximum, right? Which is to say, if you imagine a graph of like how good things are, you know, to change things, you have to go off a little hill, but there's a bigger hill further along the graph, right? And we're just stopping ourselves getting there because we're afraid to go down a little bit.
And this is worryingly like what the Brexit argument sounded like, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. Don't get me wrong. There are elements of the Brexit argument that, like, I personally didn't think it was the right choice, but like, is there a chance that in a 30 to 50 year horizon, it makes sense? Yeah, maybe. But yeah. I mean, like, you know, could we afford to bear those costs for 5 or 10 years?
It's ironic though, because
Brexit's a longer time.
Yeah, the principles behind the sort of Brexit move, I think, were principles that we generally disagreed with, right? I mean, that's our whole topic for a different episode if we ever wanted to do one on that. But I think the contrast with this is actually that the sort of the principles underlying the move to abolish the monarchy are things I think that a lot of people in this day and age could be talked into getting behind. And it's a kind of emotional hangover that keeps the monarchy in place, and then a kind of practical status quo bias, and the point around sort of diplomacy that actually stops us from really doing anything about it. Whereas with Brexit, I feel like there were a lot of underlying principles that were actually somewhat going in the opposite direction.
Being like, British.
Yeah, it's staking a claim that national identity and sort of sovereignty in that particular way and disunity from Europe are all sort of positive things in an age where actually I feel like the principle that we want to be working towards is greater international unity.
Oh my God. You know what? I feel like, having discussed it for an hour and a half now, I feel like you might have worn me down. Maybe I'm just tired, but I kind of feel like I can't, like, just because we've been talking for a long time, I'm like, I can't be bothered dismantling the monarchy. I still think it's the right thing to do, but I kind of can't be bothered.
Unexpected anymore. Victory.
I don't know that I'd count that as a victory, but like, I take a lot of the, you know, I take a lot of the practical stuff, like, you know, they probably bring, there's probably some positive financial situation. Nah, well, there's probably some positive financial situation and the cost is relatively minor. I still really strongly dislike them. But, okay, actually, wait, allow me to rephrase. I am made to feel apathetic by how unmotivated the rest of the country is, and I can't be bothered fighting that tide. I wish it was a popular opinion. Knowing that it's not, I'm too apathetic to argue strongly against it. I am philosophically, but I can't be bothered practically advocating against it.
Guaranteed.
And maybe that's exactly why they remain.
that's how we get to where we are. I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. Do we have any closing comments, remarks?
Well, for anyone who's still listening at this point, we probably should have brought it in earlier because it's interesting, but the Harry and Meghan debacle.
What did you want to say about it?
Any thoughts?
I thought it was a bit sort of, I think it highlighted a lot of the sort of negative sides of the monarchy being entertaining, actually, in that in a day and age where there are more important
way.
In a bad way, in a day and age where there are more important things to be discussing, namely sort of lockdown, pandemic, how we sort of progress from that, and climate change. And then you've got these guys being like, oh, now we're more in touch with the people in our 14 million California estate with all these chickens and
yeah.
Again, I don't mean to diminish like the sort of emotional, mental well-being of anyone, because everyone has the capacity to suffer regardless of like your circumstances. But I do
think, context.
I think context is key, and I think the media have a lot to answer for in terms of what they put them through as well. So not to diminish their suffering in any way, but I felt like it was it's one of those situations where it got an annoying amount of attention, possibly just for how much I personally cared about it.
Yep, and I think one thing that always bothered me about it was that it smacked of disingenuity.
There's a lot to be said on that too, actually. Like, was it just a cynical move? Because they very much went out,
brand move.
Yeah, they very much went out saying, you know, we don't want to, like, you know, we don't want to talk about this. It's something we want to live our private lives, so we're going to do this massive interview with Oprah.
I know,
the entire world.
I don't think it was that seems kind of contrary, and I don't think it was a coincidence that, you know, immediately afterwards or very soon afterwards, a Netflix series was announced and Harry took on two or three ceremonial positions within companies. They're basically paying him a ton to just be associated to their brand.
Yeah. And he's got a podcast now as well.
And the podcast. The thing I find really funny is when we take these, because of the royals, because they have a brand, and we start to pretend that they have some expertise in something. So like, oh, we're bringing Harry in as an expert in blah. And it's like, Harry has literally, with the exception of some military service, not really ever worked in his life. Like, he you know, before settling down with Meghan, you know, he had several scandals of like gallivanting about on public money to go on like lavish trips to Vegas, rooms filled with hookers and stuff.
Oh, and there was that time he dressed as a Nazi.
Yeah, like,
can't forget that.
Like, is Harry really the person to be talking like? It's a bit, to be fair, I'm strongly against celebrity culture. It's the same way I feel when celebrities are brought in as like experts on XYZ. It's like, oh, you know, we don't think maybe someone who, I don't know, dedicated their life to this cause, has a PhD in it, you know, actually works in it every day, might be a better person to fill that role.
Yeah, it's the depressing influence of just having an audience.
The influence of influence.
The influence of influence, having a brand.
God, I hate the fact that social collateral is now a thing.
Cool. All right. Let's close it off there. Any notes in terms of where people find us?
I mean, check us out on Facebook, Morality of Everyday Things. We have a Substack.
Yep. Again, do subscribe. Get the newsletter.
Main thing is, if you at all enjoyed this, if you can put up with us, follow us on your podcast app, so Spotify, etc. Leave a review if you can. Message us on Facebook. It'll make us feel good.
Nice. All right, guys. Cheers. Take care. And until next time.